Hey everybody, welcome to Comedy on Vinyl. This week we are talking about Albert Brooks' A Star Is Bought with Cole Stratton, who is the co-host of the Awesome Pop My Culture podcast on the Nerdist Network. Go to Nerdist.com, check them out, or go to PopMyCulturePodcast.com and follow them on Twitter as well. I also want to remind you guys that we have our live episode coming up May 28th, which is a Monday, 7:30 p.m. at IO West. Go to ticketweb.com and search for Comedy on Vinyl, or just go to comedyonvinyl.com and search for it. Please RSVP on the Facebook event page. It's linked directly to our Comedy on Vinyl fan page. And, make sure you like us on Facebook as well. Please rate us highly on Comedy on Vinyl, iTunes, that is. And, the tickets for the show are only $5. You can get a two-for-one deal if you show the invite at the door. So, you know, have that ready, print it out, or have it on your phone. Anyway, please enjoy this episode, and thank you so much.
Why do certain records become hits? In every case, the answer is the same. People heard it on the radio. People liked what they heard. People bought what they liked. And so on. But in all the years that recording artists have been trying to get on the charts, those elusive indexes of what's selling, nobody ever did what comedian Albert Brooks has done. He's assembled an album completely composed of cuts individually designed for different kinds of radio stations. In the next hour, we'll not only find out how this record came to be made, we'll actually hear it.
Jesus, the beach stinks today.
From his Malibu Heights Efficiency Villa, comedian Albert Brooks.
Everybody knows you need radio to sell your record. No airplay, no washing, right? Most artists put out a record, and if they're lucky, it gets played on one or two kinds of radio stations. That's because it's aimed at only one or two kinds of audiences. But that's taking a tremendous gamble. You're putting all your exposure eggs in one radio basket, literally. Now, I took my eggs, and I aim them at the entire radio dial. I mean, if this thing, the good Lord willing, gets the airplay that it's gonna, well, with my royalty deal, I'll be quite frank with you, I'm gonna be making some big blood donations.
Hey, everybody, thank you for coming to Comedy on Vinyl. This week, I have Cole Stratton with me.
Hello.
And we're going to be doing Albert Brooks' A Star Is Bought. So when I asked you if you wanted to come on, what was it about this album that stuck out?
You know, it's I probably listened to it the most out of anything, and I mean, the beautiful thing about coming up on Comedy Records is, even nowadays, if you want to build a comedy record collection, you can go to Amoeba and get as many as you want for $2 a pop. Yeah. I mean, it's not expensive. Mm-hmm. This is actually one that was a little harder to track down, but I remember listening to it a lot when I was a kid, and I just think it's like a perfect comedy record. I don't think there's anything missing in it. It covers every genre. It's really funny.
Yeah. I was trying to get a copy of it again because they had it at the shop that I go to near where I work, but I kept calling Amoeba every day and asking for it, and they're like, no, 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 and they kept looking for Mel Brooks every time I asked them. It's like, damn it, I had to go in person. Still couldn't find it. First of all, I'd never heard it until you introduced me to it, so it's kind of... It's very self-referential, and I don't think I've ever heard anything quite this self-referential as a comedy album. You know,
it this really is
meta, quote unquote. Has that informed your own comedy, or is it just something you love listening to?
It definitely has. I mean, I think Albert's my biggest comedic influence. I don't know if it necessarily shows in my comedy, but like, it's definitely like up there. I'm a big fan of bits, you know, as opposed to stand up and stuff like that. I kind of did a little bit of stand up, but I don't love it, so I kind of got off that path. But when I do stand up, or if I host a show or whatever, I concentrate more on doing bits with my time as opposed to like airline food. Am I right?
Right.
And that's what I love about this record is it's just a collection of bits and. And it's set up beautifully. Each track is set up with a track ahead of time that kind of explains what you're about to hear because you kind of need some context for it to really hit hard.
Right.
Though, you know, sometimes it comes up on random on my iPod or whatever, and, you know, somebody might be in the car with me that's never heard it and doesn't get the setup and still laughs at it. So it works that way. But if you get the setup to each of the bits, it's even funnier.
Yeah. When did you first hear it?
Probably when I was a kid. I think I listened to this and his other one, Comedy Minus One, quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I remember Comedy Minus One has this whole bit on there about, like, it's the comedy of Albert and you. The second side of it is, like, a comedy bit where they leave silences and they give you a script so you fill it in. So it's like you get to do a comedy routine with Albert.
Amazing.
So when I was a kid, I remember doing that over and over and over again just because it was fun for me. And you're like an auto mechanic, so, you know, just... being an 8-year-old and trying to do like a New Jersey accent, you know, this whole thing. And so that was my first introduction to him. And the first half of that album is more like his stand up and stuff, Memoirs of an Opening Act, and that kind of stuff. And then I found this one afterwards. And I think I found a rip of it online or something at some point, because it's really hard to find. Yeah. And I don't know why, because Memoirs of an... the first album's available on... I think Rhino picked it up, so you can get it on CD. It's out there. It's a lot more available.
Yeah.
But this one has never been available digitally. It's never been issued on CD or whatever. It's just on vinyl.
Yeah.
There are rips of it online, which is how I think I originally found it.
Yeah, that's how before I find it.
Finally, you know, pointed up money and bought it on eBay, and you know it goes for a decent amount of money sometimes. Yeah. You know, at least $10 to $20, if not more sometimes. But yes, I think I heard it early when I was a kid, and then I don't know what happened to it, and then I've, you know, found a rip online, and then finally shelled out the money to get it on vinyl.
Yeah, it must have been nice to rediscover it though after so long. Did your parents own it?
I think they did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I definitely was introduced. I came from like I call myself a child of HBO, so I'm really into pop culture, which if you ever listen to my podcast, it's all about that. So my dad raised me up on Albert, because you know, he was a big fan of him and stuff like that. So I definitely listened to this record and then kind of got into his movies. I used to hang out at video stores when I was a kid, so before I worked at them later on, so I used to have tons of those big cardboard standees in my room, because they would just, were given to me from the video stores, because I had buddies there after a while, and I think I was like 10 or 11 or 12, somewhere in there, and I had like a giant Broadcast News two-sided standee in my room. That's probably the only kid my age that was into Broadcast News, but that movie to me was like amazing, and you know, and my parents, it was like one of the few R-rated movies my parents were okay with me watching, because they knew I would understand it. There's nothing that objectionable in it, and the whole feel of everything for that, and I thought that was like the best Albert Brooks performance ever, and I think he's robbed of the Oscar, even though Sean Connery is great in The Untouchables. I thought just that movie was just, you know, perfect for Albert, and so I always liked his sensibility and his sense of humor, and what I find a lot, like, especially when I'm listening to this record, is I'm laughing at it, but I'm always like, that's so stupid. Like, the bits are so stupid.
Sure.
But it's that mix, that mashup of highbrow, lowbrow, in a sense, that just really works for me. Like, I mean, there's that whole track about him finding the lyrics to Bolero and translating it in French, translating them to English, and then singing over it. And it's just like, it just the concept of like, these would actually be the lyrics to Bolero, it's just, it's so stupid, and just the whole time listening to this is so dumb, but I can't help but laugh at it every time I hear it.
Yeah. How did you, well, we can move into the SF Sketchfest thing. I mean, first of all, how did that start, and you know, how did that start? Let's just go there.
SF Sketchfest, I was in a sketch group in San Francisco called Totally False People, along with Janet Varney, David Owen, and Gabe Diani. And we didn't really have that many places to perform. There's just not really, it wasn't a sketch community at that time. And I mean, there was, but there's nowhere to do it. There's a couple of tiny little hole-in-the-wall venues, a place called the Mott Cafe that had like a beam in the middle of the room, that kind of place. So we found that like, if you did it at a comedy club, people were like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
It's not stand-up, you don't understand it. If you did it at a theater, it was fine, but theaters were really expensive, and you usually had to rent them for more than a night.
Yeah.
You know, you had to pick a run-up. So what we decided to do is we banded together with five other local troops, including Casper Hauser, White Noise Radio Theater, Fresh Robots, Pleasley the Bronx, and the Meehan Brothers. And we rented a theater in downtown San Francisco called the Sheldon. This is a 75-seat black box. Rented it for a month and then called it a sketch festival, SF Sketchfest. As basically a ploy to kind of bring people in and have all of us bring our fan bases together to kind of find each other. And we had two groups co-headlining each night doing 45-minute sets. And then the last week we did was all like these cabaret style. Everybody did a 10-minute set kind of thing. And we went Thursday through Sunday for 4 weekends, basically. And the Chronicle ran a big story on it at the time. And we sold everything out. So from that, we were like, oh, maybe this could be a thing. So the second year, we moved to a bigger theater, the Eureka Theater, which is 200 seats. And we opened it up to applications for groups that wanted to perform. And we somehow convinced the Upright Citizens Brigade, minus Amy, to come and do a sketch show. And Fred Willard and his Hollywood Players to come and do a sketch show. And then it just kind of sort of took off from there. I mean, you know, learned lessons and, you know, the next year got some more people in. I think we had Fred Armisen and Naked Trucker and Girls Guitar Club, things like that, that next year. And then we just kind of branched it out and expanded it and made it all things funny as opposed to just sketch, so we weren't pigeonholed.
Because
there's only so many sketch groups
of
in the world.
Of course,
We've had Kids in the Hall, we've had The State, we've had UCB, and we've had people up from SNL, and We're not going to get Python, probably. Right. So outside of that, but we have had Terry Jones. That was cool.
Awesome.
So it just kind of blew up from there, and it's become this giant thing that still three of us run. We hire a small staff come festival time, but it's still very grassroots, but pretty insane.
How many years is it now?
We just had our 11th in January.
Jesus. Yeah. It's insane.
It's pretty crazy.
So then going back to, I mean, obviously sketch is important to you. What did this influence your sketch at all, your sketch mind, or is there other bigger influences that you...
I think it definitely did. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, it was Albert in general. Mm-hmm. But I was really into... I watched a lot of SNL growing up. Sure. I thought it was really funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, I came up in the... You know, the Adam Sandler, Phil Hartman, Chris Farley era of it was when I used to watch it every week when it was Destination Television, back before you could DVR it and watch it later. You know, my buddies and I would have sleepovers on Saturday nights or whatever and watch that.
Awesome.
So that was a big influence. Kids in the Hall was huge for me. Mm-hmm. I watched that like crazy when it was on Comedy Central, I guess HBO too. Which was really surreal for us at Sketchfest when, first we had Dave Foley come, or no, first we had Bruce come and do like a little music show, and then we had Foley, and then we had Scott, and then finally got all of them, and, now, like, they're our friends, which is really surreal and weird to think that these guys that really influenced us. In fact, we took our name, Totally False People, from the Kids in the Hall 2000 tour program.
Uh-huh.
It was in Mark McKinney's bio. There's a sentence that said, rumors that he was gay, totally false people, or blah, blah, blah. And that's what we took it from. So just the fact that that was kind of the start of everything, and it kind of came full circle and is pretty insane to us.
That's amazing. Did you ever get to... is this an album that was more something passed down from your parents, or did you get to share it with friends growing up at all?
I share it more now than I ever did then. Once, I found the rep a couple of years ago, I've definitely burned it for people and given it out because I know it's just so hard to come by.
Yeah.
And even if it wasn't hard to come by, it's hard to convince people to listen to comedy records.
Yeah, it is.
In general, especially if it's on a turntable, because, hardly anybody sits around and listens to turntables anymore.
Yeah.
Unless they're really twee. Yeah. And, are super hipster and live in Las Feliz.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if they can put it on their iPod and throw it in their car, then maybe there's a chance to listen, which made it a little more available once it was digital out there. So, people should definitely seek it out and try to find it online because it's worth the download. And then if you like it, go ahead and find it on vinyl.
You know, radio nostalgia or nostalgia radio, I guess what I'm trying to say, what I really
Newsweek
like
media
to say
expert
is,
Peter Greenberg.
All over the country, a lot of radio stations are 40 years behind the times, and where 10 years ago this might have been considered a put down, now it's a compliment.
After Mr. Brooks signed his contract and turned over his birth certificate to us,
Asylum Records research director Arlene Geffen,
we noticed that he was only 27. Well, you can imagine my shock when 2 months later, while I was doing some work in the Hollywood Museum, I came across a disc recording of an Albert Brooks radio show, dated August 4th, 1943.
Well, Arlene called me and said she had found this show. I was ecstatic. I went through the ceiling. All my copies of my show had been lost in a tragedy. And here I was, looking for something to put on the album to the radio stations that play this nostalgia stuff. What better than my own show?
So you talk about, this is something we like to talk about, is like bonding with people over comedy. You obviously had a pretty big experience, at least watching SNL. You would have like sleepovers and stuff. Is there anything else that, I mean, that included, if you want to go into detail, but just like any other bonding, did you make friends over comedy?
Definitely. I mean, I used to also be into comic books and things like that too. And I had a couple of friends that we would have like sleepovers on Friday nights and we would watch Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Oh, God.
Which, again, surreal for me. I work at Riff Trax and do commentary with, Mike. So I know Mike, Kevin, and Bill really well. Mm-hmm. And we've had Cinematic Titanic, the festival, too. So Joel and Frank and all those guys. And I've had a bunch of them on my podcast as well, too. So another surreal thing for me is, like, it's one thing to meet the people that, really influenced you in comedy.
Yeah.
But it's another thing when you get to work with them in some capacity.
Right.
That is pretty mind-blowing. And then you realize they're just people that are just funny. But
sure.
But it's always surreal to me that, I've gotten to work with these people repeatedly and and, yeah. and gets to call them friends and stuff. It's just weird. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, but that's amazing. I mean, ah, God, that's so cool. You've got the life I think many of us envy. Do you sit and still listen to stuff on vinyl? I mean,
yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like my wife doesn't like things too cluttered in the house, so most of the records are in crates in my closet. So like, if I want to listen to them, I have to really dig them out. Even though the turntable is in the front room still, but she wasn't a big fan of having those out and displayed. So though we do have in our front room, there is the art, and behind the couch is a 3x3 grid of comedy records.
That's awesome.
Which people always comment on when they come in because they just look rad and That's a great wall decor if people are, trying to come up with ideas. Because you can get those frames really cheap at, like, Michael's Craft Supply. They're, like, $5 or $6. Whereas, if you try to get them at Urban Outfitters, they're 20. So, don't do that.
No.
Go to Michael's. Seek them out there. But they make really cool, wall hangings. Especially if you can hang them in a way that is pleasing aesthetically.
Sure.
So sometimes, and we haven't really swapped them out, but I've thought about from time to time swapping the records out with other ones because there's, picking this 9 at first to be up there was kind of difficult. There's at least 15 to 20 that were like in, consideration for it.
Yeah.
But I do think about every once in a while, I can swap in a few out here and there, but I haven't done it yet.
I feel like we are in a generation that is among the last to understand comedy albums in this particular way, at least having one physically in your hand, and people still don't really release that many comedy albums unless it's just a stand-up.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, for years now, I've been talking about wanting to record, like, a straight-up old-school sketch record.
Yeah.
With either Janet Varney, who I work with a lot, or Vanessa Raglin, who I co-host my podcast with.
Yeah.
We've always talked about it and stuff, and it's not hard to do nowadays. No. You can just write the thing up, pop up in GarageBand and record it, and I actually took a couple of my old Totally False People sketches when I was just playing around with GarageBand and, recorded one of them and made sound effects and did all the voices. And it's weird to me that this just doesn't happen anymore. And I guess, there probably isn't much of a market for it, so to speak. But if you can make it on the cheap and make it as a digital download, you don't have to actually press, CDs or whatever, then I could see it. Happening. So hopefully one of these days we'll actually get around to doing that because it's just a passion project that I've wanted to do forever.
Yeah, I'm in the exact same position. I've been trying to do another one for years. I did one when MP3.com existed, when it was still a thing. I don't know if you remember it at all, but you could upload, if you had music, but we did comedy, upload your comedy, and then people could buy your CD and all that stuff.
Oh, nice.
It's the most fun thing in the world. Like, it was not a great album. This was 1999. It was 18 or 19. So... But, that's a big passion of mine, too, because you don't see that anymore. Nobody does sketch albums.
You really don't. Like, the last one I can honestly remember was the first Adam Sandler album.
Yeah.
They're All Gonna Laugh at You or whatever. Because then after that, it was just about his songs, because then it became, like, these songs albums with maybe, like, a little thing in between. But, and I remember really liking that album a lot. I think I was in college when it came out or something, and thinking it was really funny and goofy. And the concept, too, of, like, one person writes it, or a team or whatever, but then, because everybody's connected, bring your, celeb comedy friends in to, guest on a track. They just come in for a half an hour, and, you've got, like he did, like, Rob Schneider's one on a track, David Spade's on a track, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is surprising to me that nobody really does do that, because I think if you, were to do something like that, Aukerman could put out a comedy death ray sketch record or something with all those people, and it would be huge.
Yeah.
You just would have to get the right combination of people and, get it out there. But
I think it'll be a podcaster who gets it done first. There seems no doubt, just because it is such a small community.
Yeah.
You know?
And, I mean, his podcast especially is a lot like that.
Sure.
I mean, Comedy Death Ray is definitely a lot of character work and goofy riffing and stuff like that, too, which is really just, like, kind of prolonged improvised sketches.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of where things are going now, is podcasts versus albums, so to speak, because people can put their comedy out that way.
It does seem to be a huge... I mean, do you feel the huge demand? I mean, I know you guys are basically, say, about 3 a month is how you do it, because it's kind of a bitch to do it weekly or even commit to bi-weekly. Do you find it... Is there a lot of pressure to do it?
Yeah, well, it's weird. It's like, we don't keep a set release schedule because we don't want to, like... We don't want to settle for somebody that we don't want because we want to have to release, like we want to make sure that all our guests are people that we want to have on and it's hard to just book guests, consistently, especially weekly.
Yeah.
because early on when we started our podcast, it, you know, because it came out of, like, at Sketchfest, we'd had a bunch of, you know, Never Not Funny, Doug Loves Movies, Comedy Death Ray Radio, things like that, and I was like, yeah, everybody has a podcast, I could have one of those, right?
Yeah, right.
And then I just kind of called in a lot of my Sketchfest friend favors with people that had done the festival, and and we had really good guests early on, so the thing, you know, found legs, and then we were number two in Rolling Stone, and then that kind of blew it up, and now we're on Nerdist, and that blew it up even further, so now it's not as hard to get guests in, because we can say, like, here are the people who have done it, here's the Rolling Stone thing, and, you know, these many people listen to it because of Nerdist and whatever. So now we actually have people pitching to us, we have publicists contacting us, and, it's, and if we ask people, they tend to say yes.
Sure.
Though, early on, we were pretty lucky, most people did say yes that I asked, but then after a while, it's like, okay, if, you know, the 30 or 40 people I could think to call in with this have all done it, now, now what do we do? Which sometimes it's just cold approaching on Twitter, sometimes it's going through their, you know, publicist or their manager or whatever, and just hoping that they get it, and, I mean, one person did complain that, like, they you know, we have a lot of comedic actors and comedians, but we better get more dramatic actors. And it's like, I agree with you, but dramatic actors don't really understand podcasts, so they're not as willing to come on, or they don't, they think they can call in, or, you know, and we're kind of like, our vibe is like, we need to be in the same room with you. So hopefully more and more people get it, and publicists seem to kind of get it now. They understand that it can really help if you have a movie coming out or a book or something like that, if you go on the podcast circuit, so to speak. And you'll see that now, like, somebody will all of a sudden will be on WTF one week, under just the next week, and maybe on us or whatever else, and they just kind of pop around now. And that's the challenge, too, is to try to keep our guest list interesting, so it's not just, you know, the Paul F. Tompkins of the world, which I love PFT. He's done our show, like, four times, but, you know, he's on a ton of podcasts.
Of course,
you know, Tom Lennon makes the rounds, you know, Doug Benson makes the rounds, and they're all great, and we still have them, but then it's like, you know, let's get William Zabka in, you know, which, no one else is at him. We just recorded Amber Tamblyn. It's the first one she's done, which is cool. Stuff like that. Just trying to think outside the box and bring people in that aren't doing it everywhere.
There's something, and I don't want to, like, get too into podcast stuff because it gets, like I said, too meta. But there's something really personal about having a you know, your iPod with you and having just this whole show to yourself is very similar, at least to me, the way I used to experience comedy albums first on. Did you ever have, did you ever get to, like, sit and listen to a comedy album with just yourself and a record and just, like, be in your own world?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely used to, you know, sit down and listen to them all the time when I was a kid. And even nowadays, like, if I download something, I, you know, pop it on my iPod and, you know, the commute will be long somewhere or whatever. If, you know, I live kind of central, and if I had to go out to, you know, Burbank or Pasadena or something like that, that could take a while. That's just kind of the way. I mean, I feel like in general, the idea of an album is sort of dead. It's kind of piecemeal. It's track by track by track, because people aren't forced to listen to things in order, or they don't. It's not like it's a cassette tape where, you know, you pop it in and you listen to side one, you flip it over or whatever. Or even CDs where you've, you know, fast forward through the tracks or whatever. But nowadays, just, like, go on and download the one track you think you like, and you don't even have to pull the rest up. So, or you listen to it in random, shuffled between a bunch of other stuff. So there's a little less of, like, we're starting at the beginning and we're listening all the way through. And it's harder to convince people to do that nowadays. But, you know, that's the beauty of vinyl is, you know, I guess you can move around. You can lift the needle up and move it that way. But in general, you put a side on and just let it go. And, yeah, there definitely was that for me with comedy records. I mean, in addition to the Albert ones, you know, I listened to all the Steve Martin ones. Some of the Monty Python ones, like Matching Necktie and Handkerchief and things like that. The 2000-Year-Old Man records, which I thought really funny. And then ones that were just, like, totally dated, but, you know, like, I have one that's, like, Comedy from the Second City or whatever from, like, the 60s that has Alan Arkin on and, you know, Barbara Harris, people like that I love. And, you know, not I don't think at the time I understood half of what was on it. Because some of it was topical from the 60s and whatever. But, and then the Nichols and May records, too, I like a lot as well. So there's a lot of great stuff out there.
A phone call to Americans. Hello? Are some Americans there? Oh, all right. Never mind. I'll write them a letter. A letter to Americans. Dear Americans, Well, I was calling to invite you to a party. It seems that a certain country we both live in is celebrating her 200th birthday. But before you RSVP, maybe you ought to know a little more about the birthday girl. America was born on July 4th, 1776. The doctors thought she wouldn't live past her second birthday. Of course, they didn't have the medical technology we have today. Why, do you know today doctors can keep a man's kidneys alive even without his permission? And what about America's kidneys?
There's something that's kind of been brought up actually quite a few times this weekend because we record a lot of podcasts, but people are talking about some of their first experiences with comedy or listening to things they didn't totally understand, but because everybody, maybe sometimes it was their parents or sometimes their friends or older people, were just laughing. They just felt like they sort of had to, and that kind of got them into comedy. I mean, did you ever have that experience listening to stuff?
Yeah, I definitely did. I remember when I was like really young, my parents took me to see some shows that they were going to. Like, I saw Steve Martin at Michigan State, like, in the late 70s or something. I was born in 76, so or maybe it was, like, 81, 82. I was, like, you know, I was pretty young.
Sure.
But it was his era of, like, the arrow through the head, wild and crazy guy stuff.
That's amazing. And
I don't remember a lot of it, but sure. I do remember being there, seeing that, seeing the crowd freak out and being like, I want to do this. Yeah. This is great.
Yeah.
And I think we saw Bill Cosby, too, when I was younger and things like that. Like, that were pretty influential. And I spent a lot of time at comedy clubs when I was a teenager and when I was starting out in college as well, too. Mostly at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I had a buddy who worked the desk there, and so I would get into shows, like, you know, cheap or free or whatever. And then I started doing improv there eventually, which they didn't really do. It was at the end of a three-hour stand-up showcase with a kind of house team. But, you know, so I really got into stand-up when, you know, at that time it was like Marc Maron was headlining and Patton was coming up, Patton and Blankenpatch, you know.
Yeah.
We did the showcases. There's like Matt Weinhold and, gosh, I can't think who else. But, you know, these Tom Rhodes, the guys now that don't necessarily do as much, but at that time were, like, super influential. And at that time, like, the goal was to get a sitcom or whatever.
Sure.
So, you know, Tom Rhodes had Mr. Rhodes or whatever that was, a teacher show that he did.
Oh, and, okay.
All sorts of stuff like that. So I definitely, you know, I was always around it in one shape or another. And I think I started to understand it as I got older. And I also took improv classes when I was like 12. So
really?
Yeah, I got really into then. So I was always, I kind of always knew I wanted to do something with comedy. I thought I was going to like, because I was really into movies too. I worked at video stores and all sorts of things. So I actually went to San Francisco State for film thinking I was going to make movies. And then I was like, eh, I don't want to fetch coffee and roll cable for a bunch of years. I would rather just be an actor or be a performer and cutting into it that way. So, but I've always been around it.
Yeah. Have you gotten to meet Albert Brooks yet?
I have not. We ask him every year, you know, to come to Sketchfest, and there's interest, but we just haven't been able to work it out. And then this past year, we were like, oh, well, now drive's happening, and he's super busy. But hopefully, one of these days, I don't really get starstruck too much anymore because I've just been around it so much at this point, but I will definitely get starstruck around Albert.
Yeah.
And Alan Arkin, like, you know, he's been someone we've been wanting for a while, and he was actually going to come and do the festival, but had to, drop out because of his schedule, but he wants to do it at some point.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, so he's another one that I would just be super clumped around. Because like, that's my thing, too, with watching movies and stuff coming out and being, like, a completist. Like, I built film sections out at the video stores for directors and actors and stuff like that, too, so I would hunt down, like, hard-to-find weird movies that were out of print or, mostly in VHS back then, because that's what it was. So, and I remember we would go to this warehouse in Sacramento that was kind of like a wholesaler that would just take, you know, video stores that closed down, would take their catalogs or whatever, and then would sell them to other places. And so we would drive up there from San Francisco, and me and my manager, and we would spend, like, 5 or 6 hours there just, like, going through the shelves and pulling out stuff.
That's so cool.
And then, you know, they would sell them to us at a couple bucks a piece or whatever. And, you know, I really knew what I was looking for half the time, and sometimes I would find, like, things that to me were, like, the Holy Grail. Like, and movies that aren't even good, but I remember we found this Alan Arkin movie called Choo Choo and the Philly Flash. Alan Arkin and Carol Burnett. It's from, like, the early 80s. It's not a good movie, but, you know, it was super... I'd never seen it in print anywhere. I just knew it was technically had been printed at one point. I remember finding that and thinking that I just won the world.
Yeah.
And,
that's insane.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Are there any reunions that, like, are dreams and slight possibilities that you want to happen at Sketchfest, but just you're not, you don't know?
I don't know. I mean, you know, we're always hoping Python will happen at some point, you know? We have had Terry, he had a good time, and, you know, but they're, like, not only are they not in the same place, they're all over the world, which just to get them to the U.S. would be ridiculously expensive. You know, at this point, we've done so many reunions. We reunited the state a couple of years ago, like, all of them, which hadn't been done.
That's
insane. And we've had Kids in the Hall. At this point, I don't even know. We're constantly just, you know, asking people that we like and hoping that one day it'll work out. And I mean, there's people that haven't done it yet that it just feels weird that they haven't done it. Like Sarah Silverman, you know, who every year, like, wants to come but just hasn't been able to do it.
Right.
And, like, every single person she's ever worked with has come through the festival. And So, I don't know. We're just trying to think outside the box every year and do more tributes and things and bring people in.
Are there... what was the first comedy album you ever listened to, then, since you obviously listened to a bunch?
You know, it was probably Weird Al's in 3D.
Yeah.
Because I really loved Weird Al when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I still have that particular vinyl one from when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the first, like, at least the first one I owned that I bought, you know, with my allowance and put in on and loved. And Al's on the festival, too, a couple times and stuff. So, yeah, that's another surreal thing. But,
did you share that with anybody out of curiosity? Because I know that, like, Weird Al and Cheech and Chong are the two things that actually made, like, my closest friends out of. So I was just curious.
I definitely had friends that were really into Weird Al and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember especially, like, when I bought Off the Deep End and on cassette.
Uh-huh.
There was a summer where we just spun that over and over.
That's awesome.
It wasn't even spinning. It was wearing the tape out, I guess, so to speak. I definitely, you know, share that with people, too. My friends that I grew up with, at least when I grew up in Michigan and I moved out to California, like, they weren't necessarily that into comedy stuff, so they didn't quite get that part of me. But, as I got older, I definitely got more people that understood it.
Yeah. Can you remember the first time you sort of saw the value of a laugh, or maybe the first time you made somebody laugh, just out of curiosity? Some people remember that, some people don't.
I mean, really early, I used to goof around for my, you know, when the family was in town or whatever, cousins and stuff like that, too. One of my cousins, Casey, is, like, 3 weeks younger than me, and we, you know, we spent a lot of time together because our dads were in a band together. And so we definitely hung out quite a bit and stuff like that, and we would ham it up and do little shows and things like that, too. And I mean, one of the stories that my parents always tell is that when we were really little... he would go up to, the, he was, you know, he eventually became a musician, which is funny, and plays piano, but at the time, he didn't play piano at all. He was a little kid, was just pounding on the piano for, like, a couple minutes, and I was just sitting next to him for a while, pounding, and I finally just went, play something else, which cracked my parents up, and then I understood. I was like, oh, that was funny, okay.
That's good.
So, pretty early on, I definitely would ham it up and was pretty goofy.
Yeah. Do you remember your first sketches since you were in sketch and improv from pretty early on?
Oh, man.
I know.
I'm not sure what I wrote first. I know that when I started doing Totally False People, I definitely wrote the most.
Yeah.
It didn't necessarily mean it was all diamonds. There's a lot of crap. I mean, I still have binders of the stuff, you know? So sometimes I'll dig them up and I'll go through and be like, oh my God, what was I thinking? Or what were we thinking? We all have ones that we joke about being like, you know, oh, there's that one sketch and I shut up. A lot of stuff that never saw the light of day. Cause we would write individually and then write together when we liked something, we would then rewrite it and that kind of thing. So I can't even remember what the first thing I wrote was. I know I took one thing I remember is I took this thing at, ACT in San Francisco, American Conservatory Theater. They had like a something for teens thing that we had to, like, together write, like, a little show, like a 30-minute show and to perform live. Uh-huh. And it was ended up being, like, I think it was my concept. It was about, like, this, like, television family that was the Appelsons or something. They had a sitcom, but then they all hated each other outside of it. And then the writer, the ratings are bad, and they're all kind of going their separate way. And then the writer decides to kind of, like, kind of goes crazy and writes a crazy episode and puts into the prompters and they have to follow it. But it's all crazy and out there, but then it ends up being a big hit and that kind of thing. And I remember like thinking, oh, okay, yeah, this could work for me.
Yeah.
And I think I actually ran into a copy of that script the other day because my parents brought down a box of just junk from my closet in Davis. And I was like, oh, yeah, this. So I definitely was into trying to write scripts and sketches and goofy things pretty early on.
Hey, what are you doing? It's Wednesday. Have you got any place to go? If not, may we invite you to the Albert Brooks Show.
Hello, everybody. I'm Albert.
Albert Brooks Show, brought to you by your Treasury Department, reminding you that Series E war bonds have a big job to do, and so do you.
Mr. Brooks, get up, it's a Wednesday.
What?
Wake up, Mr. Brooks.
The Japanese have invaded. Take cover.
No, Mr. Brooks, you were sleeping. Wake up, it's me, Sam.
Oh, Sam, you got to remember, you're not an American. Until this war's over, you got to wake me up gently.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Mr. Brooks, but the president of the network called.
Well, why was he calling me? Did he run out of bananas?
Oh, no. He got a plenty of bananas. He say, this week's script no good. Could not be used.
No good? What does he mean no good? What's no good?
Remember your show last week?
Yes.
That was no good.
Okay, Sam, I'll handle the joke.
What joke?
Have you ever written anything that you would compare stylistically to this album? Just because it is kind of, it's basically a mock documentary for, you know, an entire record.
It really is. I don't know. I'm trying to think what's on here that might be. I mean, there's a couple. There's so many. There's four or five bits on this record that just kill me.
Yeah.
Every time I listen to them.
Yeah.
And another one that was on his other record, the rewriting of the national anthem, which I think is one of the funniest things in the world too. Mm-hmm. But like Phone Call to Americans just kills me. It's so stupid. It's just this rant, this patriotic rant that just like what I love about Albert is he's, and this definitely influences me, is he's really great on tangential stuff in specifics. So he'll just like wherever it goes sometimes. Like it eventually gets back on track, but it'll just kind of go out a little far before it comes back in.
Yeah.
And that stuff to me is what's funny. Like I'm a big fan of like the journey should be fun, not the destination.
Sure.
So I don't care if something isn't plotted out amazingly well, if it's really funny and, you know, like, some people will cut funny for time, and I don't understand that. Yeah. I'm like, okay, so great. So now it's shorter, but you cut what was entertaining.
And
I'll watch something for 20 minutes longer if I've laughed for those 20 minutes, you know? And that's why some movies have great outtakes, and you're like, why wasn't that in the movie? Like, 'cause it didn't serve the plot, so they cut it. But it was super friggin' funny, so I don't understand how that didn't make the cut.
Yeah, it usually makes it go faster, at least for me, you know, if it wasn't there.
Yeah, I agree with that. So his tangential stuff, it's like, and that's definitely in my improv, too. I'm really good with information and being specific and and just tossing stuff out there. And I'm like, I know I get off game sometimes or whatever, but I don't care. Like, if to me, it's, improv especially is about creating something in the moment, but also being entertained to the audience. Like, I'm very concerned about the audience. I want them to have a good time. You know, I will get mad at an audience sometimes if I feel like what I've put out there is really funny and they're not laughing at all. Like, I won't turn on them. Like, I won't be like, fuck you, or to them. But I will be like, you know, like, after I guess there's like, oh, they're the worst, you know?
Right.
Where I stop caring, like, halfway through the set, I'm like, yeah, I'm just gonna do what I'm gonna do. And if they're gonna laugh at it, cool. If they're not, they're not. But, and then there's other people that treat it as a very serious art form. And, you know, you need to make sure, like, well, that's not something your character would say. And I was like, well, was it funny? Did it derail the scene? No.
Right.
So I'm okay saying it. Like, I get it. So sometimes, like, stand-ups will do improv, and they'll just go for a joke, and they'll completely derail the scene, and then it has nowhere to go.
Right.
I understand that. Like, you need to keep it within the context of what you're doing or whatever. But, you know, if a scene is about, like, this couple that's not getting along, and they want to get a divorce, and then all of a sudden he starts obsessing over what got deleted on the DVR, and then you're going to specifics about that. Like, that's fine. Eventually, you'll get back to the meat of the scene.
Yeah.
But if the turnoff is funny, then there's no reason to not make it.
Of course. Yeah. Is there? Okay. So you said what are some other sketches that are like your favorites off of this?
I mean, in addition to Phone Call to Americans, which is fabulous,
which is great.
Party from Outer Space is really funny because. It's a concept now that's completely dated, but, I mean, the idea of that is, like, back in the day, like, people would take like Gold Hit Records, and they would take, they would like write a sketch around them, and then they would cut to like parts from that song,
which I had no idea about.
Yeah,
but still, long since gone. He gave me the context,
right?
So, but
so you know, so some, so in his version of it is like, well, I can't afford the royalties for these Gold Hit Records, so I'll make these songs myself, and then I'll cut around it. So the stupid concept is that he's at this party in outer space, and he's, you know, talking to people like, oh, I'm at this crazy party in outer space. Oh, there's Lassie, this whole thing. And then it'll cut to a song that the lyrics sort of a response to whatever his question was.
Yeah.
But it's so stupid to the point where first he meets Lassie and whatever, and then he meets Abraham Lincoln, and then Abe, he's like, oh, hey, Abe, how are you? And then it cuts to Abe's song, which is, ooh, I just met Lassie! Right. As if there would ever be a rock song that have those lyrics in it. And then, just to screw with your expectations, after he's been talking to all these other people, he goes like, hey, there's Richard Chamberlain! Hey, Dick! And then you just hear him go, hey, how you doing? Good to see you! Like, there's no song cut away, and it's just kills me. So that thing is always funny.
If you were to do an album, though, do you think it would be something as conceptual as this, or do you think you would do straightforward sketch?
It might be straightforward sketch, but I love the fact that, like, the beauty of this record is there's a concept is, like, he's trying to make a record that can be played on any radio station.
Yeah.
That there's a different cut for any kind of radio station out there, which allows him to do an amazing array of different kinds of bits on here within the context of, this is brilliant because you can play this on anything, so I'm going to make $1 billion.
Yeah.
And then he cuts to a bunch of his famous friends and producers and that kind of stuff, too, that kind of add some, you know, background or context to the sketches.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Rob Reiner's on it, Harry Shearer, Peter Tork and Mickey Dolenz.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really great. To me, the funniest track, the one I listen to the most on there, is the, what do they call it on here? I guess it's the... Well, it's the radio show call-in.
Yeah.
Which kills me, where he's like, the bit is like, you know, well, you know, you can guest host on radio shows all the time, but they just play it once. But if I record this, then they can play it all the time when, you know, DJ wants to go out, and then, but I'll also be the callers. So it's him interviewing himself, but not really himself, all these different crazy characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so stupid and goofy and just cracks me up every time I hear it.
What do you think he's doing that pulls it off, though? Besides being, he's obviously brilliant, but, like, what is it about it that's pulling off stupid shit like that, like, for a whole album?
You know, it's funny in a lot of different levels. Like, the timing is great in every track.
Sure.
And when he's recording these multiple voices and stuff like that, too, like, he's talking over himself or whatever, and so it's timed out really well.
Yeah.
And it's super meta. Like, it works. I love comedy that works on like 20 levels. Like, there's this old sketch that Totally False People used to do that I wrote that, was called the 12-year-old boy playwrights award contest. So the idea was, it was an award show honoring work by 12-year-old boy playwrights.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a very, like Gabe had this character named Sir Bert Hardwick, who's like a very, you know, very serious thespian who's running these awards.
Mm-hmm.
But the plays are like the kinds of things that like a 12-year-old boy would write. Mm-hmm. So the first one was like, Welcome to Booby Town. And it's just this kid touching the mayor of Booby Town's boobs because that's how they produce the nectar that, like, supports their economy. And then the second one was Mr. Giggle Fart. And it's just this guy who's just literally... All that is like, Dave would just come in with a hat, and he was just giggling as fart noises were going. And I'm trying, like, sir, can I have your account number? I don't see anything funny. He's at a bank or whatever. But then we're taking it very seriously because we'll go out and see him, and we'll bow very seriously.
Awesome.
And then the third one was some kid's adaptation of Shortcuts as a play. I don't know why, but that was like a good mixing of highbrow, lowbrow. Like, you know, like the whole idea, like, these are very serious theater awards, and you can laugh at the goofiness of that, or you can laugh at the fact that literally a guy's like farting for 30 seconds and giggling over it,
right?
Which is making fun of that kind of humor, but also being that kind of humor, which I love, because like, I hate fart jokes. To me, like, it's the laziest, like, that's why the Shrek movies should not exist.
Right, right.
They're just fart jokes.
Yep.
And it drives me crazy. But the fact that, like, okay, we're literally going to have some guy fart on stage for 30 seconds right now because I hate it.
Yeah.
But you're actually getting, but there's people are actually crying with laughter because there's somebody farting on stage for 30 seconds now.
Right.
So it works either way. You can laugh at it because you like fart jokes.
Yeah,
or you can laugh at it because you hate fart jokes and you love the fact that he's making fun of fart jokes.
Yeah.
I don't know. So that kind of meta stuff I definitely try to do in my comedy a lot. And I think that he does it, better than anybody.
It's hard to do self-aware, which is, I think, is the big level. That's the one difference between doing, that and doing what you would do, or what he would do, is there's that self-awareness there. But it's hard to do that without seeming, I guess, pretentious or just not doing it well. It's hard to do self, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it'll come off as self-indulgent a lot, and that's what you want to avoid. And I think he does.
Yeah.
And a lot of his movies, too, and some of his films that aren't, considered super famous, like The Muse or things like that, they didn't work as well or aren't great overall, have so many great moments in them, and it's just the moments I treasure in those things. There's a moment in The Muse that, to me, is, sums up Hollywood and is, one of the funniest jokes ever, which is, he's talking to this network suit, this movie studio suit guy, about trying to get his next movie greenlit or whatever it is, and then they're in his office, and the producer guy is like, "Oh, did you see Saving Private Ryan? That's the couch from the film." He's sitting on, and to me, that's just so funny. The couch from Saving Private Ryan, and the fact that he had that in his office, and he's showing it off, and I don't know. That's just amazing. To me, that sums up Hollywood in so many ways, and it's just a little throwaway joke that probably didn't get that big of a response in the theater, but when I watch it, I laugh harder at that than I laugh at most things.
It feels like it's something that's put in there for you, I think, when that happens, though.
Yeah. And I love aside, kind of what I consider to, most people consider to be throwaway jokes, to me, are, the funniest jokes.
Hello, everybody. I'm reporting from the first party ever held in outer space. Everybody is here, and I mean everybody. Old movie stars, statues, politicians, dead people, the works. Look, isn't that Lassie? Swell party, isn't it, Lassie?
I'm having a great time.
Thank you. Gee, what a polite animal. Uh-oh, here comes Abraham Lincoln. Hi, Abe.
Oh, I just met Lassie.
Me too. She's a lovely dog. Thanks for being so honest. Oh, my goodness, look over there. It's the great Al Jolson.
Don't bother me now.
Why not, Al?
I'm having lunch.
So you are. Looks good, too. Well, let's move away now and change the subject. Oh, maybe I can get a word with the Statue of Liberty. Excuse me, what brings you here, ma'am?
I'm with him.
Well, I hope the both of you have a very good time. Try the cheese dip. Looking for more people to talk to? Oop, excuse me, sir. Are you a celebrity?
No, 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 no.
I didn't think so. You don't have that certain something. Uh-oh, there's Richard Chamberlain. Hello, Dick.
Hi, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Dick.
I mean, is there other vinyl that... I mean, you've talked loosely about other stuff that you kind of treasure and the ones that you hang on your wall. Is there anything that would stand up to this, come even close in your mind?
Gosh.
It's hard, right?
Not as
comparing comedy.
Not as much.
Yeah.
There's a... And this is even on vinyl, but... I mean, I love Steve Martin's vinyl stuff, too.
Yeah.
It's all really fun to me, but...
Sure.
There was a TV special he did in the early 80s called Comedy Isn't Pretty, which is also an album, but it's not related to the special.
Oh, okay.
And it was, for network television, it was, an hour long or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally, it's just a sketch thing.
Uh-huh.
And the basic plot of it is that he's about to do this show, and they send Igor down to get this script for it.
Mm-hmm.
And he, of course, knocks it over and then brings up the abnormal script. And that's what they shoot and do for this show. So, but it's just a collection of sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of them online if you look really hard. There's one that he did that's this Western where it's him and chimpanzees, and it's to this old song.
Oh,
so he's riding on a little Shetland pony, and so that's out there.
Yeah.
And there's a diving contest thing where he's this supposed to be this ace Olympic diver, and it's him just doing cannonballs and the eating sandwich while trying to swim dive, and
it's just
really stupid and out there stuff too, and it. It reminds me of a sketch record, but it's obviously filmed for TV.
Sure.
And you can track down bits of it, but I haven't found it in its entirety. I have it on VHS somewhere, and you should try to find
it. Never heard of that. That's insane.
It was really great.
He's another guy who's famous for his self-awareness and kind of playing with what comedy is and making fun of comedy.
Yeah.
Is there anybody doing that now that you can think of that's got that kind of self-awareness, gets that meta, makes fun of comedy?
You know? Gosh, I don't know.
I know. I can't think of anybody. I hate that I asked.
People probably do. I'm trying to think that.
Because the thing is, like, I noticed listening to a lot of podcasts, I'm becoming more and more aware of stand-up, even though I still don't watch a lot of stand-up, and only grew up, the only stand-up I knew was on vinyl, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess it's kind of hard to know anybody who's doing this kind of experimental stuff.
Well, you know, John Doerr is pretty fabulous when it comes to that. Like, his stand-up is, like, really unconventional. He does, he does a lot of bits in his stand-up that are like there's an overarching arc to his stand-up a lot that you don't realize when you're watching it, but then it pays off by the end of it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always work to people, but he's like a comics in the sense that it's like, it's really mind-blowingly amazing.
Yeah.
Like, he does this bit where, he did a throwaway joke early in his set about getting a suspender or bow tie tattoo or something. Or some guy had a bow tie tattoo and he's like, what do you need to get suspender tattoos too? That's stupid or something.
Uh-huh.
And then he does this joke about fishing where it starts with like, you know, people will go up to you and say like, do you like rock music or like metal music? And you're like, no. And then they pretend to play the guitar like, you know, metal music. And then he does the same thing for fishing. Like, he's like, well, you wouldn't say that for beer. You don't like beer? Go. You don't like beer. And then it gets to this whole thing about like what if that was for fishing? And then he pretends he's fly fishing, but it goes on for like 10 minutes of him like fishing. And this other guy comes out, and they start kind of doing a sketch about like, were you looking at my wife? This whole thing, and I can't believe you're looking at my wife. Let's fight! And he takes off his shirt, and he's got suspender tattoos, which are, you know, he threw away in a joke in
holy
the first
shit.
2 minutes of the set,
yeah.
And then it pays off way later.
That's brilliant.
And yeah, and you watch and you're like, oh my god, that's amazing.
Yeah, but simultaneously a really stupid joke, but just doing it.
Just doing it for the sake of... And Ron Lynch did this thing once that killed me. They used to sing in San Francisco Comedy Day in the Park. They still do.
Uh-huh.
It's like a Sunday once a year where it's like 4 or 5 hours long. Uh-huh. It's free. It's in Golden Gate Park. And a bunch of comics do it. And
awesome.
There's usually like some famous folk who do it unannounced, or like Robin will show up, or Kevin Pollak, or whatever.
Nice.
It used to be really big. It's kind of dwindled off. But I used to go to that one as a teenager a lot. And Ron Lynch did this bit once where he came out, and it was super, you know, big. Like a lot of thousands of people would show up, and we push way back. And he was wearing this paper mache ant head. And he's doing his set, and like never draws attention to him. Like, what's going on? And about 5 minutes into his set, after doing jokes, he's like, oh, boy, you people in the back, I almost look like an ant to you.
Jesus Christ.
And just the fact that he would go to the trouble of making a paper mache ant head and wear it for the entire first half of his set for one joke, to me, was like the most brilliant thing in the world.
Yeah, it takes balls to do anything like that, and oh god, that's amazing. I often wonder, like thinking back to these guys like Steve Martin, who kind of stopped doing comedy almost, except for films, like what they would do now if they had the opportunity. I wouldn't want to see it probably because he's not a guy who's polished his act. You know, he stopped. Or somebody like Albert Brooks, but I still think I would probably pay if they did put something together again, you know?
Oh, for sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I just wonder what somebody like Steve Martin or Albert Brooks would have to lend to it now, since they're on they're at a different part of their career, you know?
It seems like now those two guys are concentrating on Twitter.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, Albert came into Twitter to promote his book initially and then got hooked, and like is the perfect kind of comic for Twitter.
That's great, yeah.
Like, his tweets are great. And, you know, Steve Martin's were too. Like, he doesn't tweet as much anymore, but...
Sure.
And then he put a book out of his tweets, so...
Did he really?
Yeah, he really
God
did.
God damn it. Of course he did.
But, like, that's the... I mean, I think Twitter is, like... People argue either way that it's good or bad for comedy of comedians, but I think it's like a joke-writing machine.
Yeah.
You know, it's 140 characters.
Yeah.
Like, and you put a joke out there, and you find out really quickly if people like it or not.
Yeah.
And you could use that to put an act together, you know?
Sure.
Or try things out, but I think it's great, you know?
People seem afraid sometimes to put stuff out there just because they think they have to hold on to it for just the right moment, which is kind of strange to me. Seems like Twitter's the perfect opportunity to not be so precious about your work.
Yeah, it's, you know, if you consistently tweet pretty funny stuff, like, people will follow you and find you, and, you know. I mean, I feel bad for people that are that big, because if they're not consistently putting out great stuff, they get a lot of hater tweets, you know. Which I don't get either. It's usually from people that have, like, following 482 followers. Three.
Yeah.
And those are the guys that are like, yeah, screw you, man. You suck, Patton. You're the worst, Steve Martin.
Yeah.
Okay. What are you doing? What, and who is reading this other than, you know, maybe they're hoping for a retweet with some hate on it because it'll bring them followers or something?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Dave Holmes and I were talking a few minutes ago about Joan Rivers, and apparently, because I haven't gotten to see the new documentary about her, but apparently she still has an office filled with filing cabinets filled with jokes. And we were, and he and I were talking about, you know, do people still have that, you know? But he said, you know, that's kind of what Twitter is now, and it is kind of the equivalent of just
it holds your jokes for you as long as you back them up, you know,
right?
Or if you go on like Favstar or whatever, it'll show you your most popular things, you can look back and be like, oh, this was retweeted the most or faved the most.
And,
you know, sometimes it just depends on what topically you're tweeting about. If it's like a couple of mine were Harry Potter related because a lot of people were searching Harry Potter or it was trending, so they found it or whatever,
right?
But yeah, it's weird.
If I usually ask this for of everybody, if you're gonna to somebody who doesn't even know who Albert Brooks is, because I kind of hope that people who listen to this don't know that much about comedy, you know, on vinyl. So, if you're just going to recommend this to somebody blindly, what would you say? So, why to listen to this album?
Listen to this album if you like laughing. But also, if you just like really interesting conceptual comedy. I mean, these are great bits. They're set up beautifully well, and then they play fantastic, and they're not that dated, really. Like, it holds up, and it came out in the 70s. It's pretty universal, and it's really, really funny.
Thank you so much for being here.
Of course.
And now let's have you plug whatever the hell's what's coming up.
Sure. Well, my podcast is Pop My Culture. You can find it at popmyculturepodcast.com or on iTunes or on Nerdist. We've done 70, well, we're recording our 75th this coming week, so it's been around for about 2 years. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's me and Vanessa Raglan talking with comedians and actors and stuff and about pop culture and movies and TV and film and whatever else, and we goof around and stuff, and it's pretty fun.
Yeah.
So there's that. I'm actually going to be in Austin on April 27th, 28th, something like that. We're playing, I have a traveling salesman, traveling improv troupe called Theme Park, and we're playing the Moon Tower Festival there, which is it's in its first year, but some really good people are doing the festival. I think Aziz Ansari and some other folks, but Theme Park is me, Janet Varney, Jessica Mankinson, Oscar Nunez from The Office, Lorraine Newman from Saturday Night Live is taking part.
Fuck.
And we might be getting one more improviser in as well. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I think tickets are like $17. They're pretty cheap.
Awesome.
We're playing a Friday night and a Saturday night. So come out to that. I think if you just look up Moon Tower Comedy or Moon Tower Austin or something, you should be able to find that website. So there's that. I'm thinking if there's anything
on
else.
Twitter?
Oh, yeah. Twitter, you can follow me at Cole Stratton. You can also follow my podcast at PMC Podcast. Yeah. That's about it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
And everybody, thank you for listening, and have a good thing.
Oh, my goodness. Half hour to showtime, and we still don't have that script. What am I going to do? Well, well, how is this the talent this evening? Look, Bill, a fine producer you are, coming around here a half hour before we go on the air. Why do you bother to show up at all?
Well, I wasn't planning to, but my golf game ended early.
Didn't you hear what happened? The network called this morning. They rejected tonight's script. I've got no show.
Relax, Brillo head. You ain't got nothing to worry about. The president of the network called me on the 14th green. Just lucky for you, I putt with a phone.
Comedy on Vinyl is recorded at Fort Awesome Studios in beautiful downtown Burbank, California. Our producer is Mike Warden, our host is Jason Klom, and he's also the editor. Comedy on Vinyl is a Stolen Dress Entertainment production. You can check out all of our other podcasts, books, videos, other audio stuff, probably some writing, at stolendress.com. And please check out Comedy on Vinyl at facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, twitter.com/comedyonvinyl, and please subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us highly, and spread the word. Thank you so much for listening to Comedy on Vinyl this week, and have a very good thing.
With Dawes Butler, Bob Hope, Franklin McCormick, Mel Reed, Sid Teller and his orchestra, the Altones, yours truly, Art Gilmore, and of course, Albert Brooks, who says, war bonds are winning the war, so buy more. Good night. We'll be right back.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.